critically, you know, Trump's only immigration proposal going in when he first announced his candidacy was the border wall. And immigration restrictionists who'd been following this issue for a long time know they kind of rolled their eyes at that. They knew that, you know, we've had barriers for a long time and haven't done much. And he's the one who made immigration policy, you know, derived it from eugenics groups, white supremacist groups, to keep out families.
Well, we clearly have to do more on this. So we're doing part two, and we're posting online at democracynow.org. Our guest is Jean Guerrero, the award-winning investigative journalist. Her book is called Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dana Guster, Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is having a program proposal drive. From September 1st through the 14th, we'll be accepting applications for new programs. Submit a one-hour pilot episode along with your application for review and potential airplay. No radio experience is required. Basic audio editing skills preferred. Again, that's KBOO's program proposal drive from September 1st through the 14th. More information can be found online at kboo.fm.
It has to start somewhere. It has to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU of Oregon is suing the Trump administration again. A white man murdered two people and injured a third at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And in international news, Sudan will pay the United States to be taken off a terrorism list. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 222 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of cases up to 25,571. The highest number of cases reported were in Multnomah County with 54 cases, Marion County with 38, and Jackson County with 25. Oregon health officials also reported 6 new deaths, bringing the total number of deaths in the state up to 433. Nationally, as of Wednesday afternoon, more than 5.8 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19, and at least 179,000 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 24 million people in nearly every country. At least 821,000 people have died across the world. Oregonians who have been part of the recent protests in Portland are suing the Trump administration for using excessive force and illegal detentions to restrict their constitutional rights. The federal lawsuit was filed Wednesday afternoon by the ACLU of Oregon. It states that, quote, the tactics used by the officers went beyond what was required for their limited mission of protecting federal property and reflected a policy designed to retaliate against and to deter protesters because of their views and beliefs, end quote. The suit alleges that federal forces violated three U.S. constitutional rights, the right to peacefully assemble, the right to freedom of speech, and the right to freedom from unwarranted government seizures. The suit was filed on behalf of 8 individuals and 2 organizations in Portland. This is the 3rd lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Oregon against federal law enforcement officials. They have also filed a suit against the Portland Police Bureau, accusing officers of violating journalists' and legal observers' rights at the protests, a complaint that was later extended to include the federal officers as well. The ACLU has also filed a suit against federal officers for their assault on volunteer medics at protests. On Tuesday night at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a white man with an assault rifle shot and killed 2 people and injured a 3rd. KBOO's Nat Moon has more on the story.
Last night in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a white man with an assault rifle shot and killed 2 people and injured a 3rd who were part of a protest against Sunday's police shooting of Jacob Blake. 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse from Antioch, Illinois, was apparently apprehended earlier today and charged with first-degree intentional homicide. Rittenhouse appeared in the front row of a Trump rally in Des Moines, Iowa, in January, and his social media presence shows an obsession with the quote, Blue Lives Matter movement, as well as the Trump administration. Rittenhouse appears in a video before the shootings with a group of heavily armed white men talking with police officers. Police in a tactical vehicle thank the armed men for their help and give them bottled water. Video after the shootings shows Rittenhouse approaching police vehicles, still holding his rifle and with his hands raised as police cars drive past him, ignoring bystanders shouting that he was the shooter. At a press conference earlier today, the chief of police in Kenosha blamed protesters for being out past the curfew, claiming, quote, the curfew is in place to protect. Had the persons not been in violation of that, perhaps that situation may not have unfolded like it did. Some officials in Kenosha have formally requested the Trump administration's assistance, though it remains unclear whether or not federal troops will be entering the city. The governor of Wisconsin declared a state of emergency on Tuesday and on Wednesday authorized 500 National Guard troops to support local law enforcement in the city. 29-year-old Jacob Blake, who was shot 7 times in the back by police while trying to get into his vehicle, is paralyzed from the waist down. 2 police officers have been placed on administrative leave. Tuesday marked the 3rd night of protests in the city of Kenosha. A curfew of 7 p.m. has been set for Wednesday night. The Milwaukee Bucks of the NBA boycotted their playoff game this afternoon to protest Blake's shooting and the police department's response. And the other 5 teams who are scheduled to play today, including the Trailblazers, will also not be playing. For KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
With the number of COVID-19 cases in the United States nearing 6 million, and with more than 176,000 people in the U.S. dead from the virus, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has altered its coronavirus guidelines. The CDC was instructed to do so by Trump administration officials. Previous guidelines urged international travelers and those traveling from COVID-19 hotspots within the U.S. to self-quarantine for 14 days. New guidelines just advise travelers that they could, quote, pose a risk to others for 14 days. This change is one in a series of alarming attempts from the federal government to downplay the effects of coronavirus. CDC guidelines released Monday for business owners and employees say, quote, don't attempt to force anyone who appears upset or violent to follow COVID-19 prevention policies or other policies or practices related to COVID-19, for example, limits on number of household or food products. The controversy includes additional softer guidelines like those for getting tested, which say, quote, if you have been in close contact within 6 feet of a person with a COVID-19 infection for at least 15 minutes but do not have symptoms, quote, you do not necessarily need a test unless you are a vulnerable individual or your healthcare provider or state or local public health officials recommend you take one. Dr. Kritika Kupali, an infectious disease expert in Palo Alto, told the New York Times, quote, if people are getting exposed and they're not getting tested and they're not isolating, that's a huge problem. Experts have called their revisions, quote, alarming and dangerous, noting that the country needs more testing, not less. The Navajo Nation vice president endorsed Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention yesterday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Vice President of the Navajo Nation, Myron Leiser, addressed the Republican National Convention Tuesday night in a video message from the New Mexico side of the reservation. Leiser officially backed President Trump for another term.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I'm excited to endorse President Trump's re-election. And Mr. President, we look forward to hosting you very soon. Come visit our land we call Dene Tra. Thank you very much.
In the prepared nearly 2.5-minute speech, Leiser mentioned COVID-19 funding, the White House Council on Native American Affairs, and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Before the remarks aired in a Navajo Nation virtual town hall Tuesday morning, Leiser justified his support of Trump, saying as a businessman, he wants to see change on Navajo land and bring in major projects to the tribe. He also acknowledged the split ticket with Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, who spoke last week at the Democratic National Convention. Leiser urged Navajo citizens to tune into his speech, whether they agree with him or not.
We are, working both sides. We are well represented in Washington. We are well represented in the state. We are well represented all across the land. And, you know, I'm thinking, if our people would merely see that and not be as critical, but, you can't please them all. And I just encourage, and I thank you for all the comments and for many of you out there have chimed in.
Leiser has been the Navajo representative to meet with White House officials. He greeted Vice President Mike Pence during a visit to Arizona earlier this month, attended a Trump event in June, and met with President Trump in May. Leiser is the only tribal leader listed as a primetime speaker at the RNC. The convention Tuesday night also heard from Nicholas Sandman, the teenager who was at the center of the viral video controversy last year involving an encounter with Native people at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Day 3 of the RNC will hear from Vice President Mike Pence Wednesday night. In spite of its controversial namesake, Lane County in Oregon will remain Lane County for the time being. KLCC's Brian Bull explains.
At its latest meeting, the Lane County Board of Commissioners reviewed a proposed name change for the county. Joseph Lane's pro-slavery sentiment and actions against Native Americans as Oregon's first territorial governor was presented. County spokesperson Devin Ashbridge.
Specifically to organize the government, protect white settlers and settlements, and manage what was then called Indian affairs. Certainly there are examples of battles and violence done under that guise toward Native Americans.
Lane County commissioners can rename the county, rededicate it in the name of another Lane, like his son Harry, who's seen as more progressive, or do nothing. A motion was passed to review potential costs, as well as incorporate feedback from the BIPOC community and revisit the issue in a month or two. I'm Brian Bull.
A Navajo man on death row is scheduled to be executed despite objections from the Navajo Nation because of cultural beliefs about the death penalty. 38-year-old Lesmond Mitchell is scheduled for execution by lethal injection in a federal facility in Indiana Wednesday night. He was convicted of killing a Navajo grandmother and her granddaughter in 2001. The Indianapolis Star reports his attorneys asked the Supreme Court Sunday to halt the execution, which was denied, and reportedly have a final request pending before President Trump. The Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services is opening a missing and murdered American Indian and Alaska Native cold case office Wednesday in Anchorage, Alaska. Other office locations are in South Dakota, Montana, New Mexico, Minnesota, Arizona, and Tennessee. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. has proposed allowing Sudan to buy its way off of a list of states that sponsor terrorism by paying $330 million in compensation to U.S. victims of Al-Qaeda. The victims in this case are the 17 U.S. soldiers who died when the USS Cole was bombed at a port in Yemen by Al-Qaeda in 2000. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Khartoum yesterday to show U.S. support for the new transitional government that took power last year following the fall of Omar al-Bashir, who ruled in Sudan for 30 years. But ministers, opposition leaders, and many other Sudanese people are dismayed about the multi-million-dollar payment to the United States. They believe it's unreasonable that the new reformist government should suffer for the misdeeds of the ousted dictator. About 10 million people in Sudan are facing food shortages, according to the United Nations, and inflation is at an alarming 130% as of June. Sudan has been on the United States terrorist list since 1993, as Osama bin Laden was based in the country between 1991 and 1996. Other countries on the list include North Korea and Iran. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Zippy Lomax, a Portland journalist whose tires were slashed by the Portland police while she was documenting police brutality. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 57. Tomorrow, expect sunny skies and a high of 82. Today in history, in 2015, Amelia Boynton Robinson died. Robinson was a civil rights activist and a key figure in the 1965 Selma to Montgomery marches. Also today in history, in 2016, football quarterback Colin Kaepernick knelt during the national anthem to protest racial inequality and police brutality. The quote of the day is from Amelia Boynton Robinson, who said, quote, "Get off of my shoulders. The foundation has been laid. Now it's time for you to build on it and get to work." Second night lineup at the Republican National Convention included three Trump family members and Mike Pompeo, the first Secretary of State to speak at a party convention in decades. With more on the story, we go to Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I'm speaking to you from beautiful Jerusalem, looking out over the old city.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo broke ranks with American diplomacy the second night of the Republican National Convention. In remarks recorded during an official visit to Israel, he boldly praised Donald Trump's, quote, "America First" foreign policy. Professor Nicholas Grossman from University of Illinois says the administration has a pattern of violating diplomatic norms.
By appearing at a political convention, giving this recorded speech, and especially doing it from a foreign country, sends a signal instead that I represent Donald Trump and his political interests, as opposed to I represent the U.S.
The Hatch Act prohibits federal employees from political activity while on the job, and a House subcommittee has opened an investigation into Pompeo's political activities in Israel. Among other speakers, Evangelist Billy Graham's granddaughter, Sissy Graham Lynch, appealed to religious voters questioning their past support of the president.
He supported religious beliefs in court. He ensured religious ministries would not be forced to violate their beliefs.
Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who's leading the investigation into the police killing of EMT Breonna Taylor in her home, mentioned her in passing. He blanket criticized racial justice protesters and echoed other speakers, accusing Joe Biden of being, quote, "captive to the radical left," unquote. Time to the convention, a group of former Justice Department and national security officials from the past three Republican administrations endorsed Joe Biden yesterday. Trump's children, Eric and Tiffany, spoke, and his wife, Melania. From the Rose Garden, she sent her sympathies to families of those who have died from the coronavirus and shared her experience of becoming a citizen.
As an immigrant and a very independent woman, I understand what a privilege it is to live here and to enjoy the freedoms and opportunities.
Again, mixing White House activities with politics, convention videos showed President Trump presiding over staged pardoning and naturalization ceremonies, even though his administration has cut operations for processing citizenship applications that critics say will prevent soon-to-be citizens from voting. A woman whose son died in a collision with an undocumented immigrant, Marianne Mendoza, was dropped from the lineup last minute for retweeting a thread alleging a Jewish plot to control the world from a QAnon conspiracy theorist. She's since apologized. Yesterday, a bipartisan pair of congressmen introduced a resolution condemning QAnon. Trump himself has declined to denounce the fringe movement, saying he appreciates that its followers support him. Alex Kaplan is with Media Matters, a watchdog nonprofit. He covers QAnon.
It has ties to violence. I think it's concerning that someone seeking elected office would try to cultivate support from that or believe that, or both.
Ammon Bundy, the man who led an armed standoff with the government in 2016 in Oregon, was arrested after refusing to leave the state capitol in Idaho. Bundy was part of protests against coronavirus-related legislation when demonstrators, some armed and unmasked, pushed past state troopers. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael explores what RNC stands for.
Run now, children, run! The RNC, the rabid nutjob capitalists responsible for national collapse, are here, bringing real nasty consequences as rationality is not compatible with them, replacing natural compassion with righteous nationalistic cruelty. Without a platform, the Republicans have nowhere to stand, but they don't need it, as they're all groveling with obsequious, delusional praise. I wouldn't mind them having their fantasy world if they didn't want me to live in it, if their world doesn't accelerate the destruction of where we all actually live. Want honesty? Just change Kimberly Guilfoyle's they's to we's. Quote, we want to destroy this country and everything you have fought for and hold dear. We want to steal your liberty, your freedom. We want to control what you see and think and believe so that we can control how you live, unquote. So vote, because we really, really need change. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Discussions about nuclear weapons are ramping up in the nation's capital, and the potential for new nuclear testing brings up old harms to people living in southern Idaho. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Restarting discussion about nuclear weapons testing is on the table in Washington, D.C., even as Idaho still is waiting for recognition of the harms from testing in the 20th century. Senior White House officials say it could bring China and Russia to negotiations over nuclear arms. And Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas won approval to add $10 million for testing in the National Defense Authorization Act for next year. But Hannah Smay with the Snake River Alliance points out that southern Idaho felt the health effects of fallout from Nevada tests of the 1950s and 60s.
Idaho has, for a long time, been a sacrifice zone for downwind contamination, as well as a storage place for nuclear waste that comes with the production of nuclear weapons.
The National Cancer Institute has identified southern Idaho counties as having some of the highest exposure rates to radiation from Nevada tests, but the state wasn't included in a compensation fund for downwinder communities passed three decades ago. In eastern Idaho, the Idaho National Laboratory processes nuclear waste from across the country. Smay says before testing would restart, communities affected by nuclear testing should have a chance to speak up.
Having a lot of transparency from agencies, from the Department of Energy, from the Idaho National Lab, and from those in the administration who are floating this idea of resuming nuclear testing will allow communities to have their input.
More than 70 scientists and scholars have signed a letter urging the administration not to go forward with nuclear testing. And Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey has introduced the Preserving Leadership Against Nuclear Explosives Testing, or PLANET Act, which would prohibit the use of funds for nuclear weapons tests. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Struggling from the aftermath of last week's storms, lower-income Iowans are urged to seek disaster aid. Mike Moen has more on the story.
Many parts of Iowa are still reeling from last week's line of storms and their widespread damage. Now, lower-income residents are being reminded that emergency help is available. The storms left scores of Iowans without power, and many are still waiting for electricity. First District Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer says food access is another big concern, with supplies going to waste during the lengthy outages. She says the type of storm that happened, known as a derecho, brought hurricane-like conditions to a region not used to something so destructive that comes with little warning.
With hurricanes, you typically have days' notice, at least, usually, to be able to get medication, prepare for not having electricity, you name it. And unfortunately, in this case, that did not happen.
And for families who might not have access to equipment such as a backup generator, the state says there are options. Through the Department of Human Services, households who currently receive food assistance can request replacements for food that was destroyed or spoiled. Those households have 10 calendar days from when they discover the food loss to complete the application. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has come under fire over what some say has been a slow response from her office. Going into the weekend, she defended the state's approach in dealing with the emergency and sent in the National Guard to help with efforts to restore power more quickly. Meanwhile, Finkenauer says Iowans need all the help they can get right now.
We need shelters. We need food. We need ice. We need gas. You name it.
On Sunday, Governor Reynolds did submit the state's request for an expedited federal disaster declaration, seeking nearly $4 billion in assistance. As for more state-level aid, Iowa also offers disaster relief grants to households that meet certain low-income requirements. More information is on the Department of Human Services website. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
Researcher Lisa Davis has found evidence of enormous floods of the past, and she says similar events could happen again. In fact, we're seeing some of it happening already. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 1867, after several days of rain, the Tennessee River surged over its banks and water rushed into Chattanooga, Tennessee. The devastating flood remains the worst in the river's history since record-keeping began. But Lisa Davis of the University of Alabama is digging in the dirt and finding evidence of even larger floods in the more distant past. When floodwaters recede, they leave behind minerals.
And so we search for these deposits and we date them and we build a chronology of events. And in some cases, we're actually able to reconstruct what the height or the size of the flood was.
At their research site in northern Alabama, her team has found evidence of several Tennessee River floods larger than the flood of 1867. And she says such events could happen again. As the climate warms, extreme rainfall is growing more common in the Tennessee River Valley. So Davis says it's important for planners to understand what they could be up against in the future.
That information can be used to figure out whether or not dams have been adequately designed. Has anything happened that's bigger than what they have imagined?
Not just in the past two centuries, but over millennia. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A South Dakota group is planting edible forests to address food deserts in the state. Mike Moen has more.
A South Dakota nonprofit is working to create edible forests to provide lower-income communities greater access to healthy foods. Project Food Forest, based in Sioux Falls, wants to help eliminate food deserts, areas where there's no grocery store nearby that sells affordable, nutritious products. While community gardens help fight hunger, Kim Rockman with the Project Food Forest says they can be hard to maintain in a neighborhood with limited resources. She says food forests require some volunteer work after they've been established, but don't need as much attention because they're made up mostly of self-sustaining perennials.
There's no one-size-fits-all model for a food forest. We have done vegetables. We have a few vegetables in the ground now, but that's definitely the focus is the perennial plants.
The perennials include fruit trees, berries, herbs, mushrooms, all types of edibles, grown in conditions that mimic nature and offer variety for those who might otherwise lack access. For now, Rockman says the group's primary work is across the border in Laverne, Minnesota, classified as a food desert by the USDA. But she notes there's a lot of need on the South Dakota side as well. A 2018 study that involved the Augustana Research Institute identified a handful of food deserts within Sioux Falls, citing poverty as an underlying cause. But healthy food access also is an issue in rural South Dakota, with long distances between grocery stores and few public transportation options. Rockman says her group gets requests from other parts of the country, too, where communities need guidance.
A big chunk of what we're doing, in addition to the hands-on hyper-local work, is how can we bridge gaps?
Supporters of this movement say they're not trying to replace the work of community gardens or food pantries, and that all these resources complement each other. They also point out that food forests have environmental benefits by creating tree canopies in urban areas lacking in nature. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Nat Moon, Dan Raphael, and Jenka Soderbergh. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, reporting on the latest news in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers. Tomorrow, the discussion will feature a new book of poetry by Lauren Camp. And at 11:30, tune in for Words and Pictures, featuring an interview with comics storyteller Carol Lay. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line by Zipporah Lomax, who is a local Portland-based videographer, photographer, has been out live streaming the protests since the end of May when they started, and recently experienced what a number of vehicle operators who are in the vicinity of the protests have experienced, which is the slashing of her tires. And I wonder if you could just start by telling us about your experience the night that the police slashed your tires.
I have been, for most of this time, a lot of the time, you know, when I was back in like Rose City Justice days, which feels like ancient history now, I was doing what I termed car marching. And so I would use my vehicle as my means of transport. I also have several real disabilities, so it's my mobility. It's a thing that allowed me to actually participate. And so I would often be behind the march, going 1 to 2 miles an hour, also serving to protect the protesters from other vehicles. So it served multiple purposes, me having my car. When things kind of moved more to the JC, when the feds were here, I was on foot more because it was just a couple block radius, right? And so
JC now being the Justice Center downtown for for listeners,
yes.
If that's the main site of protests, although protests have been in other places around the city, especially in recent weeks.
It's sort of the heart, but now, yeah, in like recent weeks, it's been this sort of like popcorning actions. And usually starting at some park and moving to some precinct nearby. That's kind of the pattern of it. And if it seems like it's going to be a short march, then I sometimes will opt to do it on foot because I can do a few blocks. But I can't do these extended marches. Even between Laurelhurst and the 47th precinct is a bit. For me, it's kind of right there on the edge of, do I want to go on foot or do I want to be in my vehicle? I just was feeling a little uneasy that night, but also my pain levels had been pretty high. So I opted to take my vehicle that day.
I'm remembering they needed some vehicles to also be part of the motorcade protecting. It was one more reason to take my car. And I should also say here, another reason why I need to be in my vehicle is because I cannot risk being tackled by the police the way I've seen them tackle so many people. My body will not endure that. My spine is fused. I have 2 18-inch rods in my back. So I just can't risk that. So I took my vehicle that day, and I was having some technical issues. So I spent most of my time when we were at the precinct, which was a very short little window of time. I spent most of my time in my car troubleshooting my connection because my live stream kept failing. And by the time I finally got it connected and went out, it was within like 5 minutes of me starting to stream outside my vehicle that they declared it an unlawful gathering. And I hadn't seen anything that was provocation for that, but that's generally the case. I've seen a couple water bottles thrown and then they declare it an unlawful assembly or a riot. And I know what that means. So I then moved back to my vehicle. And made to like turn around, but I had to like full U-turn. By the time I was in my car, they were already pushing the crowd. I could tell just the whole energy of the crowd was like the really quick moving. So it was difficult for me to even make the necessary U-turn without hitting people. But I at this point I have a lot of experience kind of moving around bodies that are walking. And being very aware of like the perimeter of my vehicle, and I'm in a little Prius, by the way, so it's very quiet. But the police were really aggressive that night. They were pushing, and LRAD, the long range acoustic device. For those who don't know what we just call the squad car that has the LRAD mounted on top of it. We just refer to that as the LRAD or DJ LRAD. LRAD was saying over and over and over again, move east or move west immediately, move west immediately. And everyone was moving west very rapidly, and they just kept pushing and they just kept pushing. And sometimes they'll push and they'll like push a block and then they'll form a line. But this night they just kept pushing and kept pushing. And you could even hear some of the protesters saying like, what do you think we're doing? We're doing exactly that. That's what we're doing. And then I was kind of right behind them. I was seeing the police tackle people right to my left, like destroying a wagon that had medical supplies and eyewash and other water and snacks, and tackling people exactly the thing I said I can't risk them doing to me. And then I had sort of a split second decision, and the whole crowd turned left onto 44th, and so I turned to follow them. And pretty quickly the police were surrounding me, and so I can't actually, I've been instructed that I can't actually discuss the nitty-gritty details of what happened because of potentially taking legal action against them. But what I can tell you is that they attacked my vehicle at that point, the police. I was in compliance. I was only going like 1 or 2 miles an hour anyway, and I had my hazards on, and they were yelling at me to stop when I did. They apparently decided they still wanted to disable my vehicle too, according to their statement, that I was interfering with their attempts to clear the road. And they had plenty of room to move around me, but they attacked my vehicle anyway with me in it, and I slashed the tires, they smashed the window, and I'm still traumatized from it. In fact, I haven't been able to go out except for just to the kids' marches. I was going out a little bit in that first week after taking a couple days break. I went out too soon, I've realized. And as my therapist was explaining to me, I was just re-traumatizing myself every time I went out. The cops would come near me and my heart rate would shoot up. And yeah, so...
Your window was smashed as well as your... tires being flat?
Oh yeah, they shattered my rear window. There was glass in my lap.
And did they then take you into custody? Did they say
no.
They issue you a citation?
Nope. They didn't cite me. They just kept moving on, and there were two squad cars behind me, and I was having a full-blown panic attack. Nobody came to check on me. Their statement, they clearly must have at least needed to acknowledge that they've done something, which they haven't acknowledged every time they've slashed tires. But this was kind of, I think I was one of the first in this recent like rampage that they've gone on, and they made a statement saying that I was interfering and that they to remove the hazard, they disabled where they deflated the tires and passed by. But you can see from all the videos, there was plenty of room for them to move around me. I was not in their way at all. And there was enough room for those SUV squad cars behind me to pass by me. And also, how do you remove a hazard by disabling the vehicle and making it unable to move? That doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, they created the hazard.
Yeah, it seems kind of counterintuitive. And I have to ask, I mean, there's been a number of vehicle attacks on the protests. People who have don't like the protests for whatever reason and have driven cars into protests.
Have the police
taken similar action against those vehicles as using their vehicle as a weapon?
Not that I've seen. Well, in fact, you know, I live streamed a horrifying, I mean, thankfully nobody was hurt, but I was live streaming a moment when a pickup truck went around the blockade. It had to like drive on the sidewalk to go around the blockade and came up towards the crowd and was moving towards a Lombard, like on Lombard, a big crowd of people. And everyone, I mean, people put themselves in the way of these vehicles, including somebody on a motorcycle who drove his motorcycle in front of the truck to try and stop it. And that guy like ran over the motorcycle and dragged it. Then he just accelerated through the crowd, dragging the motorcycle. And thankfully everybody got out of the way, but you could see just like sparks flying from this motorcycle being stuck underneath this truck. And then he apparently pulled over a couple blocks past that and got out of his car with a rifle. And we were told that the police picked up that guy, but then he was released without charges. I mean, yeah, I don't know that the police are around to be able to use those tactics on those vehicles, but I do know that they seem disproportionately intent on disabling the vehicles of people who are participating in or supporting the protests.
And it's something that has happened several times to a vehicle known as the snack van that that comes and provides sustenance to protesters, food and snacks, but isn't actually participating in the protest. Have you seen the police? I mean, it seems like they're specifically targeting that vehicle and others that they've identified as being sympathetic to the protests.
I mean, it certainly would seem so. If you meet, you know, snack van, our friend who does the snack van, if you meet this person, they are the kindest, the most non-threatening person, and they also live in their van. So it's another layer of totally messed up that they like. There've been several times now I've lost track where they've slashed all four tires, and now they smashed their windshield. It didn't shatter like mine did, but I have seen there's like a big, you know, like it looks like they hit it with a rock, like a big boulder or something. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't understand what their logic is. I mean, other than terrorizing us and trying to make it so that we don't come back, which, you know, I was really determined that first week that they weren't going to win. You know, but the problem is that they've made this personal for me now. And while I was
sympathetic before and completely invested in terms of documenting and live streaming and being an independent journalist, I'm actually terrified of them now. I don't know if they're trying to make us not come back. They're trying to, like, cripple the people who are supporting them. Like I said, I was really wanting it not to be effective, whatever if they were trying to make me not come back. But I've had to take a break now. My nervous system is forcing me to.
The other things that you've seen at the protest, does it seem the brutality of the police is unjustified and unwarranted based on the actions of the protesters as you've watched and seen?
Absolutely. It's been disproportionate the whole time, which is part of why it felt really important for me as a live streamer to be streaming continuously, to not just be doing little clips that then I post, because if people who aren't there can watch it unfolding in real time and make their own assessments, they can see for themselves. There's nothing about this that is a riot. So this disproportionate response, I mean, to me, it's like it's so normalized. This is just how they are now. And it seems like they just, when they're tired, they decide to call it an unlawful gathering or unlawful assembly or riot or whatever. Like I said, I've seen people throw water bottles.
And in your opinion, it's the Portland police that's been pushing the violence to begin?
Yeah, I mean, if we're zooming out and looking at it, if they had just honored the demands as they were outlined a couple months ago, this may have ended a long time ago. What was asked for was the defunding of the police, which a lot of people don't understand. That means, like, taking funds that are going to the police and reappropriating those funds to community building initiatives, etc. If they had actually, during that budget session, actually defunded the $50 million instead of $15 million, which was like